You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Libya has been constantly in the news since last month's attack on the American consulate in Benghazi. In last week's debate, President Obama said that despite that attack, many Libyans still think of America as a friend. Is he right? What is the real situation there? Ethan Chern's new book, Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution, may provide some answers. Mr. Chern served as a U.S. diplomat in Tripoli in 2004 and as an economic and commercial officer there from 2004 to 2006, for which he received a Meritorious Honor Award. He is the co-founder of the Abbasima Group, which is an organization that works to develop medical capacity in eastern Libya. His book is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today.
Hello. Very pleased to be here.
Weren't you in Benghazi on the day the American consulate was attacked?
Unfortunately, yes. I was in Benghazi starting from the 10th to about the 12th. We left the day after.
How aware were you at the time of what was going on?
Well, I spoke with the ambassador the afternoon of the 11th to arrange for a meeting the following day. And I spoke with one of his security detail about half an hour later. The first call with the ambassador was about 7:30 p.m. I spoke with one of the detail about an hour later. And subsequent to that, spoke with the same gentleman just as the attack was starting to take place.
Well, the first response was that it was part of the protests we were seeing around the Islamic world in response to an anti-Islamic online movie. Do you think it was at all related?
Well, that seems to be, from the information that we were getting on the ground, seems somewhat unlikely. There was no sign when I spoke with the ambassador of any commotion outside the embassy. Presumably he would not be speaking with me if that were the case, and he sounded very relaxed and upbeat.
Mm-hmm. Well, aren't the circumstances behind the attack still kind of unclear?
Well, it's a bit of a mystery as to why the circumstances are continuing to be so unclear. I mean, the certainly, you know, there's a lot of information to be collected, which couldn't be collected because of the situation there, which was, you know, legitimately quite dangerous. And there's been a lot of in the absence of a clear timeline, et cetera, there's been a lot of additional information that's been introduced, which has not always been factually correct.
So what do you think was the cause? Was it just simply an organized terrorist attack?
Well, it seemed obviously I was not on the compound, so I don't have I wasn't an eyewitness, but the circumstances, you had the anniversary of 9/11, you had a pattern of attacks dating back about 6 months on high-level diplomatic targets. There was a very interesting article that came out in Sharq al-Awsat, one of the Pan-Arab dailies, on October 7th, which contained an interview with one of the Libyan guards who was out front, and goes into great detail about what he claims happened on that during that time, which has details which I haven't seen repeated elsewhere.
And they were?
Well, according to that account, there were eight very heavily armed leaders, attackers, of which four of them were in some sort of, seemed to be running that group, and 50 or so non-armed onlookers. Of course, that does not quite square with reports of, you know, I've heard hundreds of armed attackers, which does not mean that the attack was not planned. I think it clearly bore the hallmark of an attack that was either planned recently and for which the ambassador's presence was a window of opportunity, or sometime previous.
In an op-ed for the New York Times the day after the tragedy, you wrote that we can now expect a strong temptation among governments and private enterprises to declare the Libyan experiment a failure. What exactly is the Libyan experiment? Do you mean the transition from the fall of Gaddafi to the current situation, or
right,
to the future situation?
Yes, I think people, including many Libyans, many people looked at Libya as a success, particularly in once Gaddafi was removed and the liberation was in process. And there have been a number of successes which one should not let be washed away by events like this. They're still significant. A transition from an unelected limited but organized group of people to an elected National Assembly. People leaving positions of power voluntarily. Peaceful local elections. This is quite not unprecedented, but close to that.
On the other hand, there are still pockets of resistance, areas that are controlled by people who might have been seen as pro-Gaddafi in the past.
Sure.
So
yeah.
This is a country that's still in a certain amount of chaos, isn't it?
Of course. And I'm not sure one could really expect at this point anything other than that. Surely everyone would hope that things would have calmed down by now. And there is incremental progress. There have been tens of thousands of former Thuar rebels being integrated into the National Army. I mean, this is it's not enough for the government as it is now to claim control of the country. But it's progress.
So what about your prediction? Have governments and private enterprise just thrown up their hands and said, we can't deal with this?
Well, when you hear that that certain agencies in the States are not able to do a proper investigation in Benghazi because of how dangerous it is, it's not exactly an incentive for American enterprise to rush in. And I think there has been at least a hiatus in that process. Hopefully, in a few months, things will get back to where they were.
Weren't you about to be named a vice consul in Kuwait in 2004 before you wound up in Libya? What happened?
I was. I joined the Foreign Service a bit. I was in my early 30s at the time, and I was hoping for an exciting assignment. Kuwait seemed relatively tame, but in a volunteer cable came out, and it was for a position in Libya, and they were looking for someone with a bit of a oil background, economics, and who could read an Arabic paper. And
so you speak Arabic.
I speak Arabic.
So that made Libya the perfect place. But this is Libya under Gaddafi.
That was Libya under Gaddafi, yes, which is a very different animal than Libya today.
Well, were we changing our approach to Libya at the time?
Well, of course, a lot of things had happened in the preceding year. There were accelerated talks with the regime about giving up weapons of mass destruction, participating in exchange of information about terrorist groups. Gaddafi had been spreading his influence in East Africa, Somalia, other places which were of interest. The Kenyan-Tanzania bombings had taken place. The time was right from the perspective of the United States and the Bush administration to convert a rogue state.
So it was called a reconciliation program.
A rapprochement, reconciliation, whatever you want to call it. Gaddafi, on the other hand, was looking for a way out ever since the beginning of the UN sanctions. So that's where the sort of I talk about competing narratives, where Gaddafi was telling his people one thing, the United States was telling its the other, and the truth somewhere in between that.
My guess is Ethan Charin. His book, Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution. What was Libya like when you arrived in 2004? You said it bore the markings of a totalitarian state. Phones were tapped, rooms were bugged, foreigners were usually followed. Did that continue the whole time you were there?
Oh, yes. It actually gave me a very, very good insight into the way that Libyans think. I mean, I think that there's a sense of a climate of paranoia that just pervaded the society, somewhat like, not unlike Tunisia, Syria, other places. But people in Libya were continually in fear of someone ratting them out. And there was this sort of at that time in 2004, there was a certain optimism that things were in fact changing. That the Americans for one were back. The Europeans had been back for a couple of years.
Was there a feeling that there were a lot of hidden human rights abuses? Because some only surfaced after the 2011 intervention.
Yes, well, and that's actually a very surprising thing, is that there are things like the Abu Sulaym massacre, the one that is talked about here, the 1,235 odd, you know, people being massacred, political prisoners being massacred in a prison that's in the outskirts of Tripoli. We didn't hear much of that, and that was a big question that I tried to answer in the book.
A lot of people would have known about it, especially the relatives of the victims.
Yes, and the process of reconciliation between the regime and those families had started back in 2001. So why that was not more of an issue is an interesting question.
Did you agree with the image that was painted of Gaddafi as a crazy guy? Ronald Reagan called him the mad dog of the Middle East. Anwar Sadat had called him the wild man of the Middle East.
Yeah, I think some of these insults could be a little more creative, but Gaddafi was not. I've certainly read quite a bit about him. I've sat in watched him deliver endless speeches, and I never actually personally met him, but. He was obviously a very complex man. I don't agree with the notion that he was. He certainly was not. He was an intelligent person, and his mind worked in strange ways. And I think that the ways in which his mind worked were very confusing, partly on purpose and partly by nature, to anyone who was dealing with him. And that was one of the secrets to his longevity.
Well, there were all those stylistic changes, the hats and the uniforms and the mustaches and such, all things that would make him look a bit of a buffoon to outsiders. And yet he seemed to run a rather effective dictatorship.
Yes, and I think that buffoonery, if you call it that, you worked very much to his advantage because it disarmed people. People underestimated him. They thought he was. They questioned his both his sanity and his intelligence. But the man was very clever.
Well, you go back as early as the 60s and 70s, where the growing Libyan diaspora affected Gaddafi's decision to build up his security forces. What was going on in those decades, and why was that period so important?
Well, the 60s and 70s were a period of great. Well, Gaddafi's coup was in, in 69. The first years of Gaddafi seemed to be relatively benign. He ruled as a part of a junta, for which he was not the sole actor, but was essentially understood to be that.
And was the feeling that it was an authoritarian country rather than a totalitarian country?
I think people were sort of waiting to see what was happening at that point. But some of his decisions became increasingly erratic, and his tendency towards wanting to control things became quite obvious. A group of technocrats staged a coup in 1975, and that was sort of the throwing down of the glove. The late 70s, that sort of started a period of consolidation of any possible and neutralization of any possible competing source of power.
And Gaddafi felt the need to crack down on Libyans abroad as well as the ones in the country.
Yes, in 1980 there was the famous Stray Dogs campaign, where he sent people to four corners of the earth to track down Libyan expatriates who were against the regime, mainly to prove that he could get you wherever you were.
Were they killing them?
Yes.
My guess is Ethan Chorin, who was one of a small number of U.S. diplomats sent to Tripoli in 2004 to help reestablish a formal diplomatic presence there. He spent a lot more time there than I think he probably ever imagined he would. And he's written a book called Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution. It's published by Public Affairs. We'll continue a conversation after this. We are back with Ethan Chorin, who, as a U.S. diplomat, served in Tripoli in 2004, and then became an economic and commercial officer there from 2004 to 2006. He's written a book called Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution. It's published by Public Affairs. Did the world start paying more attention to Libya and to Gaddafi after the Lockerbie bombing in 1988?
It paid more and less attention to Libya. I think the Lockerbie bombing essentially was the trigger to. It took 2 years for Gaddafi to be fingered as the primary culprit, and for the UN sanctions to be imposed.
And you say the verdicts in the Pan Am and UTA cases came as a shock to him and his close associates. Why, if they were behind them?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think at this point the fact that Gaddafi had something to do with the Pan Am bombing is the consensus is that is accurate. Exactly what was going on there beyond that, who else might have been involved is still something of a mystery, I think.
Well, there's often a debate in this country over whether the imposition of sanctions really works. It did in South Africa. The jury is still out in some other instances. What about in Libya?
I think the record of sanctions, it's a long process, as we've seen in Iran as well. It takes many years for sanctions to have an impact. And they definitely squeezed Gaddafi very, very, very hard. And it also empowered the Islamist opposition in the country, which was increasingly successful in not in killing him, but in pressuring him to try to seek to find ways out. And that was the backdrop of the reconciliation from his perspective.
Well, sanctions are a lot easier when the country isn't awash in oil, as Libya and Iran are. And when you apply sanctions, you're also can affect oil prices, can't you?
Sure, you can. I mean, Libya was not at the time a major, such a significant supplier to the U.S. that it could not be replaced. There were certain assets to Libya being out of the Straits of Hormuz and proximate to Europe. The quality of the oil itself was very high. There were lots of benefits to that, but that wasn't a major.
Well, how did he deal with the sanctions? He obviously reached out to other countries.
Yes, he reached out to the Saudis, to the South Africans. There were endless numbers of a large number of attempts over that period to try to spring himself, and they were largely uniformly rebuffed by the United States, which really wasn't very much interested in that. I think that the idea was the analogy I used was sort of it was a joke on the Jay Leno show about Waco, Texas, that just build a fence around it and call it a jail, which was the attitude to the U.S. We really weren't interested in Libya per se.
Well, did sanctions cause popular unrest in Libya?
Well, that's another really interesting thing. Over this period, and I document that in the book, there were a number of increasing popular uprisings, if you want to call it that. Certainly not on the scale of what happened most recently, but the trajectory was upward. There was a large riot in Zawiya in 2002. There was much unrest caused by the aftermath of the 1996 Abu Slem massacre. All of these things. There were riots at soccer games, and all of those things had a potential to become flashpoints.
What led to the lifting of sanctions from 2004 to 2011?
Well, I think in the late 90s you saw, first of all, the Kenya-Tanzania bombings, I believe, had some degree of influence in bringing U.S. policymakers to take another look at Libya for the potential information that Gaddafi might be able to provide on al-Qaeda, which was just surfacing at that point. The other countries were increasingly successfully lobbying for trying to avoid the sanctions and breaking the sanctions, so that looked like an increasingly difficult sell. And the most obviously was the Iraq War. And I think that at this point in 2003, Libya looked like, the situation was becoming more and more known and bad in Iraq, the Bush administration was looking for something that they could point to as a victory. And this notion that Gaddafi was so afraid of himself being dragged out of a spider hole like Saddam Hussein was, the narrative went that was what flipped him to change his mind.
And also abandoned his nuclear program.
Such as they were. That's another issue in the book is, you know, I think I'm not
How dangerous was it?
How dangerous was he? Gaddafi had a long history of basically going on weapons buying sprees and buying lots of material that was defective or incomplete or for which there wasn't training provided. And I'm not a nuclear non-proliferation expert, but I've read certainly practically everything that I could get my hands on in this regard, and a very large number of specialists maintain that he was really very quite far from developing a nuclear weapon.
But as a kind of a boogeyman, he was effective in that area. We could say he's dangerous because he's trying to build nuclear weapons. On the other hand, he did all sorts of things that might not be seen as acceptable, but the United States and the UK looked the other way.
Yes.
Because we wanted this narrative of Gaddafi becoming more moderate?
I think it's a very complicated process. I think, you know, there are a number of individuals across the NSC, the White House, the State Department, Department of Defense, who were very much against rapprochement with Gaddafi. Interesting that the neocon sort of movement was ardently against any dialogue with Gaddafi. They basically thought, look, if you're going to deal with Gaddafi, get rid of him. I mean, it's a little bit flip. But, you know, why?
How did they plan to do that?
Well, I think their argument was that Gaddafi is perpetuating human rights abuses, et cetera. It's not this doesn't strengthen the case that they were trying to build for Iraq.
So then along comes Arab Spring. Was that the catalyst for the change in Libya, or would Libya have exploded anyway?
Well, I argue in the book that the situation in Libya was ripe for some form of civil unrest. I mean, you had large numbers of unemployed people, as you did youth, as you did elsewhere in the Arab world, and in North Africa in particular. And you had this escalating series of popular outbursts. I mean, 2006 was a clear warning shot. In February 17th of 2006, there were riots in Benghazi, which were organized by Gaddafi himself against an Italian minister who was wearing a T-shirt emblazoned with the offensive Danish cartoons that denigrated the Prophet Muhammad. His goal was to pressure the Italians to speed up reparations for war crimes, you know, many years before. But it turned into a popular uprising against the regime, and government offices were torched.
Well, Benghazi seems to be a flashpoint. You would have thought it would be Tripoli, the capital of the country.
Well, no, because Benghazi was the center of opposition to Gaddafi for many years.
But then it becomes a place where Americans are attacked. The Americans helped to topple Gaddafi. You would think that people would have been grateful.
And I think the atmosphere in Benghazi is one of tremendous appreciation for what the United States has done. You know, Ambassador Stevens was palpably both known and appreciated there, which doesn't mean that you don't have a minority of people who have other agendas and can cause great harm.
My guest is Ethan Chorin, Chorin. His book, Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution. You say that the Libyan uprising was born out of a flawed reform process. How did that work?
Well, I think one of the arguments that I make in the book is that, it's fine to, you know, at one point that the narrative that we described earlier, the rationale on the U.S. side for engaging with Gaddafi and his own desire to get out of the straits of sanctions created an opportunity for a deal, which was struck. And one of the, I think, defects in that deal was the lack of any kind of a mechanism making sure that Gaddafi both understood what was expected of him in terms of good behavior and holding him to it. The Lockerbie negotiations itself, the payment mechanism, negotiations around that for the victims of the Lockerbie bombing was a negotiation between the lawyers on behalf of the Libyan regime and lawyers on behalf of the family. The United States government was not a party to that agreement. Yet the agreement tasked implicitly the U.S. government tied payments to specific forward movements in the diplomatic relationship. So Gaddafi very, very skillfully turned what would have been his continued greatest opponents into effectively a lobbying arm for himself.
His son, Saif al-Islam was viewed as a reformist for a long time. Then he seemed to play a very different role after the uprising.
Mm-hmm.
Was he a force for reform initially?
Well, I think this is part of the sort of the ironies of the whole process is that I don't take any position in the book about what exactly was going on in Saif al-Islam's mind, but I think the reform process needed a spokesman, both from the U.S. and the West and the Libyan side, and Saif al-Islam was by dint of his character and the sort of his having spent more time in Europe and places like that, he was a charismatic figure. So he was the sort of the natural foil to Gaddafi, and the reform efforts that he propagated helped create networks and individuals who were essentially a class that was of the regime but yet not of the regime. And I think that was a key force in Libya being able to articulate a request and a series of objectives at the during the revolution.
Some people are arguing that we should apply the Libyan model to Syria, but judging from the responses in the debate last week, neither Mitt Romney nor President Obama are considering that approach. Some of Mitt Romney's advisors have been calling for it. What do you think?
I think the Libyan model is not, there are some lessons there, but they have limitations. Libya, Syria is a far more complex society than Libya is in terms of the sectarian divides, the fact that it's sandwiched between multiple other flashpoints. The conflict could very easily turn extraordinarily nasty, and really, as we've seen with Lebanon recently, already has indication that it will. So obviously, that's a decision that one would want to take very carefully.
Have you given up being a diplomat?
Have I? Yeah. Well, I left the State Department in 2008 for a job in the private sector. I enjoyed my time there very much, and I have great admiration for what the State Department and our diplomats do.
Ethan Chorin's book, Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.